Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new and improved episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I am joined by my co-hosts, the man, the myth, the Casey, the Bloodworth.
Hey, how's it going?
That was nice that time.
Yeah, that's true.
See, it can be nice.
You know, I feel like you have ulterior motives, but we'll see. See how it plays out.
But we also have our other co-host, the man who is allegedly always nice.
Seems impractical, right? Seems
have
exhausting.
Have you seen him be mean?
No, but sometimes still waters run deep, right? Like, he might say all kinds of things when it's just him and his girlfriend.
That's true. That's Michael. What's up, Michael?
Not a lot. I'm glad that you guys are confident in my ability to gossip with my girlfriend.
I didn't say that. He said that.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know who won't gossip about you? Our sponsor at Oasis Games. You can check them out at oasisgamesslc.com. You can get 15% off of your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. And you can get 4% off of every order by using the code Would That Be Good? No spaces. It's a pretty good deal.
It is. It's a slamming deal.
It's a pretty great place to buy Magic cards.
That's true.
It's like the only place that I buy them from.
Yeah, I don't think there's any more places, are there?
Not that I've bought from.
Yeah.
Not recently, at least. Yeah, I buy all my cards from Oasis Games, and I encourage you to do the same thing. They really are a great place. They have great customer service. They deliver quickly. If you haven't checked them out, that 15% code is real, real good. You should check them out. That code is CCMTG.
It certainly is. You're not going to find a better deal than 15% off.
Yeah. You can also support the podcast directly by going to patreon.com/CCMTG. We have a new patron named Tim G. Thank you so much, Tim. We really appreciate everything that comes in through the Patreon. Each patron it means the world to us. And please reach out to me, Tim, whether it be on Facebook, or you can email me at spencerhowland@gmail.com to set up playtesting times for your patron reward starting next month. And, you know, we look forward to working with you, and we really appreciate the support. You can be like Tim, too, and be eligible for things like Card of the Week, stuff like that. Just check out patreon.com/CCMTG. All right. Hashtag always improving. Hashtag always improving is the first segment on this podcast. Each week, we will talk about something that has made us better at Magic or life in general. So, Casey, how did you improve at Magic or life in general? And why is hashtag always improving so important to you?
Well, it's important because it represents a mentality, and it's a mentality that you have to have in order to get better. If you aren't trying to find ways to get better, you're not going to. You're going to plateau, and that's the same as getting worse. So it's always going to be important. And the way that I got better at Magic this week is not forgiving myself for losses, where, you know, maybe you make a mistake, but then really, like, after you make that mistake, you draw 9 lands in a row. It's easy to say you lost because you drew 9 lands in a row, but really, you made a mistake. And you have to take accountability for that and find any point that you had that lowered your chance of winning the match. You have to own up to those.
Yeah, each individual decision is a different chance to win a match of Magic.
Absolutely.
So, how what happened? You don't have to go into, like, specific details, but, like, what brought this about?
Well, I was another PPTQ, another second place finish for me this week, and in game 3 of that match, of the finals match, I made a pretty poor attack trying to play around a card that I really couldn't beat anyway, trying to play around Tragic Arrogance, and I was playing too scared. I could have waited a turn where my Advocate and my Lumbering Falls were bigger and, like, been in a much better position to win, and then just said, you know, I can't beat Tragic Arrogance, so there's no point playing around it. And then I made the attack. It wasn't very good. I started to fall behind, but then things just kept, like, the game didn't end that turn. It went on for quite a while after that.
It ended way later.
Yeah. So, but that was really a critical juncture of the game. And, like, from that, after that, I think I only drew one more spell for the rest of the game, and that was frustrating. But had I not made that poor attack, I would have been in a much better place.
I think you drew Den Protector, specifically.
Did I? I thought it was a Gideon. I don't think I drew a Den Protector that game, did I?
You lost with a Den Protector in play and one in your hand from looping them.
That might be true.
So.
No, I don't think so. I don't think I drew, because that would mean that I had, like, 5 spells that game, and I don't think I did.
you played a Den Protector face down real early. It died. You then played a Den Protector and got it back. But you had like no other. Your graveyard was like 3 cards.
Yeah.
That happened.
Oh, maybe that's true. Maybe when my Den Protector died, I didn't flip it up because like actually there was nothing to get back. Yeah. Yeah, it was an ugly game.
But that's, it could have been a Gideon that you're thinking of. I just remember the Den Protector play. But I think that it's pretty important to realize something like that. How many times do we focus on the last turn of the game as the turn that we lost the game rather than like something else that actually mattered other than that last turn?
Great. Yeah, this was on turn 5, and I think the game went until turn 12 or 13.
Yeah, it went pretty long. So I think that's a great way to improve. For me, it's a life thing this week. I played what I knew. I knew my matchups. But I really only played one matchup the entire tournament this weekend. I played against green-white 4 times in the Swiss and twice in the top 8. So it was... Or 3 times in the Swiss, 4 times in the top 8. Is that right? Let's see.
That can't be true.
So I played against it round 1, round 2... Or round 1... Yeah, round 1, round 2, round 4, drew round quarterfinals, semifinals. So sure.
So 5 times total.
That's a lot. Yeah. It is tough to beat a deck 6 times in a single event.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. But I knew that matchup, and that's like great. I don't know that that makes me improved at Magic, but I did improve outside of Magic in a way that I can apply to Magic. This week, one of our listeners on Facebook messaged me and told me that somebody was talking about us on Reddit, and so I went to Reddit.
What did they say?
I don't care. I mean, I do care because I think that my comment initiated actual feedback. And, you know, typically when I see something on Reddit, I get really upset. Like, and it's not like that thing that's being said on Reddit is upsetting me. It's basically Reddit in general boils my blood. And instead of doing that, I just, you know, said, I'm sorry. Like, if I'm sorry that you feel this way. If, you know, there's something that we can work on, I'm happy to work on it as a podcast. And I took a step back and, like, decided not to be angry about something like that and not let it affect me, but instead looked at it as a possibility to improve. Because every criticism that somebody has of you is somewhere based in some form of truth in their mind. So that means that, like, even if at the end of the day it wasn't a mistake on your end or it wasn't something that you did wrong, at least you can think to yourself, is this something that I can improve on, and make your decision that way. Because if you don't do that, you are losing out on opportunities to improve. One time I was talking to my boss at work, and we were talking about customer satisfaction rating surveys that they send out. And I had a low number of emails captured to send those surveys out, but I still got like the most CSATs, they call them, on my team. And he goes, why is your email capture so low? I was like, why does it matter? I still get the most of this. And he goes, well, you could get more, right? Each time you don't capture that email and give them an opportunity to give you feedback, you lose out on that opportunity to improve. And I had never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and it's a good way to look at it. Like every opportunity you have to do something, anything at all, right? Like,
yeah,
you take it. Otherwise, you're just not doing anything.
I think circling back to Casey's point, this is sort of like being results oriented versus being process oriented, right? It's like, even if you don't believe in this particular case the feedback is useful, getting in the habit of doing things the right way and looking for feedback is going to give you more chances to improve in the future. Just like, even though your numbers at that time were high in your job, you know, getting more chances for success gives you a better chance of continuing to, you know, to do well into the future. And I think that Magic kind of breaks down that way too a lot of the time. Like, you might lose the game on turn 15, but if you're really trying to maximize every opportunity, that includes deck selection, mulliganing, you know, land sequencing, everything throughout the game, you're going to find yourself winning a lot more.
What about you? How did you improve at Magic or Life this week?
I improved at Magic by taking active steps to play more. Because I can't play PPTQs for about a month now. I started playing Magic Online a little bit more this week. Played a bunch of Legacy Gauntlet with the Legacy GPs this week, and got both to have a lot of fun playing a format that I didn't have as much experience with, at least recently. And I think hopefully set up a plan to continue being successful in the future.
Cool. Did you love it?
Yeah, it was awesome.
Legacy's the best.
If you haven't played really much of the Legacy Gauntlet, it's a great way to get sort of a low cost
exposure.
Yeah, low cost, low pressure exposure to a really fun format. And because you don't have to choose your own deck, there's like less worry about positioning and all the stuff that normally goes into deck selection. You can just worry about having fun and playing the games the best you can. I think that's a really enjoyable way to get to experience Magic.
The podcast has slash me have an announcement. So sometimes when something happens, I like to talk about it during this segment to kind of keep you guys up to date. And so for those in the Facebook group, they know that I'm getting a new schedule. And I'm happy to announce that the reason I'm getting a new schedule at work is because I'm getting promoted. So I don't know how that's going to affect a few things. There will be no episode of Limited Time Only this week. I'm not sure what's going to happen here. There will probably be significantly less editing of the podcast. So the podcast is going to change in structure a little bit to accommodate that. And the post times might also change. It might go back to like Tuesdays as a post time. I'm not sure. I don't know what's going to happen. But I thought I'd let you guys know that I no longer have the middle of the week off where I was doing a lot of the work for like content of the site, you know, doing recordings with Matt, recordings with these guys, recordings with, Drew, and then, you know, editing all of that, putting it into video files, putting it into audio files, turning it into MP3s, putting it on YouTube, putting it everywhere. I'm not going to have that luxury anymore. So we'll see. We'll see. But you guys will still get the podcast every week. And I just get Sundays and I just get weekends off now and probably Mondays. So that's I don't know. Maybe we'll start recording Sunday nights and I'll just post on Mondays and you'll get like a really, you get the podcast, you know, really early in the week. I'm not sure. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But this week we have Patreon participation from one of our patrons. It is from, is it Adrian? I believe it was Adrian that submitted this. And he says he wants to know how to play while ahead and winning and what pitfalls to avoid in that situation. Casey, you kind of talked about this. I mean, I guess you didn't talk about how you were ahead in that game, but you didn't feel ahead in that game.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were pretty close to parity. My hand was just terrible, so I felt behind. I don't know what his hand looked like.
So you had two more lands than him.
And three in hand. So if, like...
Well, you had two more lands than him, one of them being a Lumbering Falls. You had one more Planeswalker than him, and two more creatures with them, one of them being a plant token, correct?
Yeah. So I had way more creatures, but three of them were plant tokens, and two of them were knights. I think he had more like creature cards in play than I did.
I think he had one Sylvan Advocate, one knight. He might have actually just played his Nissa he drew off the top or something.
He definitely had two knights because he double-blocked my Advocate with them. He had two knights, a Gideon, a Sylvan Advocate, and maybe that was it.
So maybe he didn't have the Nissa yet. I think he might have drawn that later.
Yeah, I think he might have played that the next turn. Or no, he did have a Nissa on play because it was on six.
Yes, that's right, because you were attacking it.
Right, so he had some amount of plants. I don't know how many.
Yeah.
His plants may have been chump blocking, so he may have only had one. I'm not sure.
I think he might have only had one plant. Either way, from the outsider's perspective, you were way ahead. Like... You had three cards in hand. You had, you know, more creatures in play. You had, you know, your Planeswalkers had been in play longer. But you felt under pressure because of your hand.
Well, yeah. And that Nissa is a ticking time bomb, right? Like, yeah. if he draws six off that Nissa, that's game over. You can't come back from that. So I was trying to find, like, how to not lose to that. I just needed to deal it a little bit of damage. I didn't need to kill it. I just needed to deal it damage. And I did have one more turn to do that. It was just... I was like, okay, so if I just say go and he casts Tragic Arrogance, this game is over. Mm-hmm. But really looking back, you know, we just talked about what I had. I wasn't beating a Tragic Arrogance with that board. Like, I was going to
especially not with a hand, right? Even if he had played it, like, it's not like you could have reloaded from a Tragic Arrogance either way.
Right, yeah. I was 0% to beat a Tragic Arrogance. So playing around it is just wrong. So, like, and I was trying to cover all the angles, but, like, I just overlooked the obvious one of, like, there's just no point to that, to going down that road.
So, I think... Oh, go ahead.
Let's speak a little more broadly here. When you identify that you're ahead, what are you looking at?
That's what I was just going to say, is the first step is probably to identify that you're ahead.
Right. So I think the easiest way to do that is if you look at sort of your board development, right? I mean, if you play very much Magic, you will have a good gut feeling for when you're ahead. But, you know, you look at your board and their board, right? And you're thinking, okay, am I in a position where I have, like, good attacks? Or if I'm trying to defend something, I have good blocks? You know, so basically, what needs to happen if this game continues like it's going, if we both basically just trade off our spells one for one for the rest of the game, I'm probably winning. That is what when I would feel like I'm ahead in the most broad sense.
And I think that that's where Casey found that he had three lands in hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the game if he just continued to draw lands.
Right. If we start trading resources from this point, like, assuming that he has basically anything in hand, if we start trading resources, I'm going to lose.
So if you have some kind of, if you have something you're thinking about, so you're saying, okay, well, I know this is the deck my opponent is playing. I know these are the cards he's probably playing. So you've identified that Tragic Arrogance is a card that, you know, even though you're ahead, it would probably put you far behind and be very difficult to beat. So you make that identification, right? And you're thinking, okay, well, I don't want to lose to Tragic Arrogance, but it seems like then here you've basically said there is nothing you can do to play around that. You're just going to lose to this card in this game.
Yeah. Well, and even beyond that, I left myself soft to Declaration in Stone with the attack on the plant tokens, which allowed him to kill one of my planeswalkers, which was really bad. But, like, I knew that he had four Declaration in Stones, and he definitely had less Tragic Arrogances than that.
Right.
So, like, there were just quite a few things that went into it.
And this is a specific example. Right. Like this is just a moment where I think that it's easy for all of us to have this happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's we feel behind because of what's happening when we might not be. And in two turns, Casey might have been behind. Right?
Yeah, very easily.
And you were trying to... I think you were trying to avoid the situation of getting behind.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's what caused the misplay. When you're ahead, it's probably not right to risk like that.
Yeah, you don't need to play that aggressively when you're ahead. Well, right. Biggest thing.
You have to identify cards you can and can't beat, right? If you can play around Tragic Arrogance, play around it, but don't open yourself up to still losing to Tragic Arrogance in all likelihood and now losing to Declaration in Stone. I think that's the easiest place to improve your game.
I think the pitfall here is playing around things that you can't beat, playing around things that you don't need to, and, you know, the key to playing ahead from my experience is, does this have a significant impact on what the outcome of the game is going to be in a few turns?
I think that's a really good point. So when you're starting, right, you might not play around anything. You might walk head, you know, if you've never played much Magic before, you might walk headlong into something you could have played around. But the trick is identifying what they could have and separating them sort of into categories of what is worth playing around and what can I just not beat. What is irrelevant? Yeah. What is worth playing around, and what can I not beat? No matter how hard I try.
In this format, I've played against an unreasonable number of counterspell decks, specifically with Grixis, and I'm always fascinated when they spend a counterspell or a kill spell on my Kalidus, and I'm like, what are you doing?
What exactly is Kalidus supposed to do in this matchup?
I'm always shocked, and I'm thinking to myself, well, that just was percentage points in my favor. And the thing is like, they're not thinking like, oh, he spent four mana on literally a 4/3 in this matchup.
Right, yeah. It's Kalidus, like, is certain cards just, like, get by on reputation alone sometimes. Where Kalidus, like, you think of that card as, like, being some of the thing that really blows you out.
Yeah.
But, like, now, if your deck doesn't have creatures in it,
it could be that they board it into creatures. Like, I guess it's not literally a 3/4. They could have something want to give them the benefit of the doubt. But usually I just find that to be a peculiar line. And, you know, it's something where I think that they would be farther ahead if they just took a couple attacks from that and waited to use a sweeper on it. You know, waited to use a Languish until I play a Goblin Dark Dwellers. I mean, I need to put more pressure on them than just a 3-4 for that I didn't play until turn 4. They've established so much presence as the control deck that it's going to be hard for me as a mid-range deck that's, you know, masquerading as a control deck to really catch up. And that's the thing is you need to realize that sometimes in a matchup you might start from ahead.
Yeah, that can be very true. Like, if you play turn 1 Mountain Goblin Guide, like, you are ahead, right? Your opponent is on notice. And, you know, they can catch back up from just that pretty easily. But, like, playing, knowing when to recognize that you are ahead and, like, how to make the correct plays, how to realize, like, at what point your opponent has the ability to take that from you.
In the top 8 this week, in the semifinals match, I was on the play, game 2, and I played turn 3. He played a turn 2. What is the name of the card? Glamwell Pacifist. I played a turn, and then he passed back to me. I played a Nissa's Pilgrimage, passed back to him. He drew a card, played a land, and passed the turn. I played a land and played a Reality Smasher and attacked him. And this felt great, right? Like, far ahead. He then tapped 3 mana, played a Secure for 2, untapped, played a Gideon, made an Emblem, attacked me for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, I'm crazy far behind.
And which is crazy because 2 seconds before I was in this very good ahead position. And that's something that's interesting. I kept the hand because I was on the play and it was 3 lands, 2 smashers, and it might have been 3 lands, 3 smasher, and then the
but you had envisioned yourself in sort of the beatdown role in the matchup, I mean, and when that
was the only thing my hand could possibly do, right?
Right.
But I quickly fell from ahead to behind, and I, you know, the plays after that got so hard because it's like that what you know, playing from ahead in the beatdown role is different from playing from behind in the beatdown role. It's like knowing your role also plays a factor into these situations. And, you know, to avoid those pitfalls, it's really important to, like, know, like, what can I beat, what can I not? You know, the thing is that I might have won that game if I had just played another Smasher and attacked him back for 10, right? But the problem is that if he untaps and plays a Nissa and minuses, I'm actually dead on board.
Yeah, or another Gideon, or there's a few things that you are pretty soft to.
You're sort of half dead to either, right? I mean, you're no matter how you play it, you're going to be dead to basically half of the options.
Well, here's the thing is if he plays Gideon or Nissa and then attacks me with everything,
right?
I block his 2 guys, play the other guy and kill him dead.
Well, but he's not attacking if you hold him back, right? I mean, the flip side is if you don't attack and say...
I did not attack. Should I have attacked?
I think it's close. I mean, say you don't attack and he... I mean, obviously if he has like a... But I don't know. Maybe he has a Dromoka's Command or something, so you don't get to block effectively. Or who knows what exactly he has. But I think it's interesting when your roles are shifting in a matchup, you know, so you think, okay, with this hand I'm the beatdown, and then you get halfway into a game and you're now forced to make a really tough decision on, okay, am I going to try to pivot? Is my deck in hand in a spot where I can try to pivot and slow this game down and play defense with Reality Smasher? Or do I need to just try to kill him as quickly as possible because I can't possibly win a longer game?
The thing is here is that it's important to know where you're at in the game. How far ahead are you? Are you far enough ahead that, like, the only thing that you need to do to win this game is not F up?
I mean, so when you're like that far ahead, it's sometimes considering like, okay, is it correct to, I don't know, attack badly to squeeze in a few points of extra damage? You know, sometimes you are in a position where you realize, there are tons of things that just kill them dead next turn. And if I draw this out, it's only going to get worse for me. Who knows?
PV has always said to me that he plays significantly slower when he's ahead. And I'm the same way. If I'm, like, really far ahead, I
Right, because you at that point have the luxury of being able to play around things that your opponent might have. You know what I mean? Like things that are sort of unusual, but sideboard cards that, you know, one in three decks play. Things like right. like the more narrow stuff where it's like, okay, let's think about what the chances that they could have X, Y, and Z. What are the chances they have X, Y, and Z?
Sure.
Like, do I get really punished for playing around one and like leave myself more exposed to a more common card? You can really start to ask those questions where when you're behind, you just have to be like, okay, well, I hope you have nothing.
So the real pitfalls, kind of the ones that I highlighted before, know where you're at. So to avoid like being in the wrong spot, the wrong time, like thinking in your head when you're behind, thinking you're behind when you're ahead, you know, play around the things that matter. Play around the things that you can afford to play around at the same time. And I think that if you do those things, you'll find yourself winning more games of Magic.
I think in particular, a lot of the time, when you're behind, you have to draw something, whereas when you're ahead, you have to consider everything your opponent could draw. And that makes it harder at times. Yeah.
Next up, we have our power rankings this week. We have Legacy with the Legacy GPs this weekend. Coming in, the way that this works is each deck gets points according to finishes. We add the points together and give them rankings. So it's 6 points for first, 5 points for second, 4 points for third and fourth, 3 points for a top 8, 2 for a top 16, and 1 for a top 32. Coming with 9 points with a little bit of a resurgence, we have Storm.
Great deck. One of the sweetest decks in Magic's history. It's very all-in
common. It got some new toys recently.
Yeah. Dark Petition. In a deck that has no problem getting to 5 mana, and certainly no problem having spell mastery, this card looks a lot like Demonic Tutor, which is banned because of this deck. And so, there are factors.
It's the fair Demonic Tutor in this deck, right? It's the Demonic Tutor that you're okay Force of Willing.
Sure.
Whereas the other one, you had to Force of Will, but you didn't feel okay about it because they could still win.
Well, and it
was
really
the trap card.
Yeah.
It only really works when they're already going off, right? Basically, you have to be casting rituals already in most games.
Yeah, whereas they could also just cast a turn to Demonic Tutor and...
sure.
Right, yeah. Turn to Demonic Tutor for Cabal Therapy. Get your Force of Will. Right. And you're like, what's happening? I know I'm losing, but I don't know to what.
Yeah, and this card's much more, you know, fair.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking.
I'm a huge fan of Storm. I love watching the deck. I love playing against the deck. I decently enjoy playing with the deck. You know, it's something that I think is a thing of beauty in Magic, and that is underappreciated, and people talk about... I mean, the Storm... What does he call it? The Storm...
Scale?
The Storm scale is like... It feels demeaning to Storm.
No, I think
like, Storm is a problem.
No, I think it's respectful. Like... Mechanics and cards and concepts that were just so, like, powerful that, like, Storm, by its nature, is overpowered, right? Like, it's uncounterable, it's impossible to interact with. Basically, any Storm card that has ever done anything has seen play.
That's literally what he says about... I was listening to a podcast, and he goes, so basically, this is how the best way to explain Storm... Every Storm card we ever printed that, if you did something enough times, would actually win the game eventually, has in fact been banned in some format.
Right.
Right.
Like, have you ever read the card Grapeshot? It's not that impressive.
No,
Two mana, one damage, common sorcery, too, right? Yeah, it's banned in Pauper.
Oh, of course it is.
Yeah. And
why wouldn't it be?
And Empty the Warrens.
And what are they just banned another one, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, they did. Temporal Fisher. And that one has buyback, right? But there is a Storm card that does that.
I think the problem with Temporal Fissure was that you were bouncing like some of your own permanents, right? There was some kind of like...
Oh, no. It was just a hard lock you out of the game combo. Like, they would get up to a bunch of mana and then, like, bounce all of your permanents.
Right, but they would also bounce something to, like, return their Temporal Fissure to their hand, right? So they could do it...
No, Temporal Fissure has buyback, so you can return it to your hand automatically.
Does it have buyback? I think it's just 4 and a blue.
Oh, apparently those are the only two with... I think Temporal Fissure has Fissure Storm.
Is it the card that I'm thinking of?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, so Temporal Fissure is the Storm one. There's the one with buyback also.
Capsize.
Is that one banned?
No.
No. Okay.
No, they banned Cloud Post and Cloud of Fairies instead.
Yeah.
Capsize is slower and generally sees play in fairer
decks. What a sweet format. Anyway, so we're talking legacy, guys.
So yeah, exactly. Storm cards that do anything. And Temporal Fissure can't even win you a game. It's a 5-mana sorcery speed disperse. That's a terrible card. But you get enough of them, and like it looks a lot like Game Over. It's a one-sided, you know, Armageddon plus Wrath of God, which is pretty powerful. And so Storm is sweet. Like, I think it's, like, one of the most fun decks in every format, and it really, like, makes you... You have to respect it, right? If your opponent starts casting Dark Rituals, like, you immediately know this game hasn't gone your way.
I don't know how I feel about Reign of Filth in this deck.
I feel like it's crazy bad.
It's just the last ritual, right? I mean, that's the thought process.
In theory, it's like a fifth Dark Ritual, but in practice, it feels a lot like a terrible Magic card to me.
Okay.
Because, like, sometimes you have, like, a swamp and an island and you're trying to go off on turn two, right? Or, like, your best hands will never include Reign of Filth.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I have a hard time with it, but I think it's probably a fine one of.
I like how we just have started calling this Storm and stopped calling it Ant.
Well, because people used to be two Storm decks, but nobody ever plays the other one anymore.
Epic Storm's not worth it anymore?
No one plays it. That one is the Rite of Flame, Burning Wish... Empty the Warren Storm deck. So people are just fully on the Past in Flames. Well, or do they both play Past in
Flames? They both play Past in Flames. Well, that card's broken, so...
Right, it's Yawgmoth's Will.
Yeah, Past in Flames also, I think, really changed the dynamic of this deck quite a bit.
Yeah, because it used to
It was a long time ago, right? It was Innistrad, but people who don't play Legacy don't remember Storm before that card.
It used to be Ad Nauseam, and let's see how that goes.
Yeah. but this deck is sweet. I recommend... If you're going to play it, like, play some games first.
A lot. This deck's...
Or get it in the Legacy Gauntlet and wing it. Yeah. And, whatever.
And go for it.
That'll be fun.
You know, try and figure out what you're trying to do with it. But I love Storm, and I'm glad that it's a deck in the format. I think that it has very good matchups against the fair decks and can beat unfair decks pretty reasonably, you know, with Cabal Therapy and Duress Main. And
just some amount of, like, turn one kills, right?
And some amount of turn one and turn two kills. So I don't think... There's only a couple turn one kills, right?
No, there's a reasonable number.
You just have to have Lion's Eye Diamond and...
Yeah, you usually need something. I mean, sometimes it's just, like, Swamp, Ritual, like...
ritual.
Infernal Tutor for something that's already in your hand. You know, empty out your hand, kill you. Like, that's a real line.
All right.
Okay. I mean, with an LED, Infernal Tutor, Double Ritual, Swamp, I mean, that's like four or five cards, but that should basically do it, right? I mean...
Yeah. Lion's Eye Diamond, I think, is pretty important to the turn one.
But it is something that can happen. It's certainly a fun deck to play.
I have done lots of turn two kills with the deck.
Yeah, for sure.
Next up, we have Infect coming in with 10 points. I've kept my opinion on this deck. I think this deck is... Only good players can play it, but it did win a GP. I don't actually think this deck is that different from the modern deck, but Casey, you think it's completely different?
I think Invigorate is a broken Magic card, and I think that Berserk is a broken Magic card. So just having access to those changes the dynamic of the deck quite a bit.
What about it changes it?
Because you can actually, like, you don't, your mana investment for your kill turns is much lower, so it's easy for you to hold up interaction of some variety, where like in modern Infect you usually have to spend all of your mana on your like combo turn,
mm-hmm.
just a combo, where with this, you know, those two cards represent lethal and only cost a combined total of one mana.
Last time you and I talked about this deck, you called this deck grindy, where the other deck can't do it.
That's true. Having access to crop rotations and counter spells and dazes, like, you can kind of pick your battles. Wait, okay, on your end step, crop rotation, get the Inkmoth Nexus, like, on my own time, when I'm ready to do it.
My games with and against this deck, I don't find it that different. Like, I mean, I think the difference is really the format more than the decks. I think that, like, the fact that you have Daze and Force of Will doesn't make this that different of a deck. Like, it just means that your protection is different.
So I sort of agree with Casey in that, like, a lot of both your pumps, with both your pump spells and your interaction costing very little to sometimes no mana, it's just a deck that is very difficult to play against, and a deck that, I mean, even more so than the modern one, can really get you out of nowhere.
I think that that's just true of both of them, though. Like,
so, like, your, like, turn two and three kills, those are the exact same in both formats, where it's just, like, getcha. Like, you didn't have it, stupid. Better luck next time. But I think that, so like maybe like 50 to 60% of your games play out very similarly. But I think the ones that don't, like this deck, one, I mean, you can, like, it's three cards, right? Or four cards, including the land, for a turn two kill. And, like, Modern, in fact, doesn't really have that in its range. So the fact that you can have those four cards and then be able to have a Force of Will and a Daze backup, you know, I think it makes it more explosive, which is just Legacy versus Modern, sure.
That's my thought. I think that the decks are different in, like, a lot of ways, but I don't think that it's deck-specific as much as format-specific.
But I think, like, for, like, most Infect decks play at least one Wasteland, sometimes more, where, like, I would never play a Wasteland or anything like that in Modern. In Infect, or like even if that was the only deck that could play Wasteland, you wouldn't play it because it's just so far not part of your game plan.
Okay. What do you guys think of this deck in the format, like where it's at?
I think it's sweet. It has a really good Miracles matchup, so whenever that deck is running around, which is always, this is a good deck to prey on it. It's kind of soft to the Volcanic Island decks in general. Almost all of them are pretty good against Infect. So it just depends on what your metagame looks like.
But I think it's soft to Jund, too, personally, in my experience.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, any deck with a ton of removal, I think, is going to be...
Yeah, the Punishing Fire decks, there's a lot that can go wrong for you playing this deck, but there's a lot that can go right, too.
That's true. I think that, like, the deck, I mean, I personally can... This isn't the way I think about Magic, so it's, like, hard for me to play. But I admire it.
It feels too like a deck that is very, just very difficult to play against at times. And it's not the kind of deck you get to make a lot of mistakes against.
That's true. Very punishing.
And anytime you make a mistake against it, you basically die.
Grixis Delver, or sorry, Charlas Sultai is next. Why did you write that?
Copy and paste.
Oh, you should be ashamed. Charlas Bug is next. It comes in also with 10 points. This significant drop-off. But we did see this resurgence of Storm. There was all kinds of decks that were preying upon this and the four-color Chromox deck. So, not surprised to see a drop. Honestly, I still think it's probably the second best deck in the format.
Yeah. Death and Taxes was super popular. Sneaking around. Death and Taxes is crazy popular in Europe. It's like one of the most played decks at every European Legacy event.
I say that that's like a really bad matchup for Shardless.
Uh-huh.
But I do pretty well against it, but I still think that, like, typically, I think that if a deck's Death and Taxes player plays like perfect, like, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, Death and Taxes is a sneaky hard deck to play where, like, people can just pick it up and like don't really know what they're getting themselves into. They think, "Oh, yeah, White Weenie. I know how this all goes." But it's not that at all. It's a control deck that plays mono creatures.
Yeah, that deck's very powerful and not that great of a matchup for this. But, you know, Shardless gets to prey upon both Delver and Miracles, which puts it in a really good spot in the Legacy metagame right now. I would recommend trying this deck out. It's, if you like mid-range control decks, like, this deck is a hootin' good time.
Yeah, Shardless,
it literally hoots. It has Belfer Strux in it. Yeah. Thank you.
I have to say, I was thinking, I was like, man, I didn't know they started playing Hooting Mandrels. I was really confused for about a second and a half, and then was like, oh, okay, this is an owl joke. Okay. All right.
Grixis Delver is next, coming with 18 points. This deck has been in the top three for the last couple times we've done this. I think this deck is great. I think that the inclusion of things like Deathrite Shaman, you know, I think this deck was hard to figure out for a lot of people. I think that this deck specifically was like, how do we make this color combination, the color combination that we play with Delver of Secrets? I think it was like a puzzle that was really, really hard to solve. And I think they've got there.
Yeah, I think that it's also interesting, and they managed to find a Delver of Secrets deck that isn't fun. I think this deck is, like, I think it's much better than any other Delver deck, but I don't like playing it very much, and I don't know that I ever will, but I think that it's very powerful. You've got a lot of really great tools in this deck.
Yeah, Gurmag Angler, Young Pyromancer, Deathrite, this deck is everything I want to do.
It feels like you have a lot of different angles to attack from, which probably helps you in broader metagames. Just, there's kind of something for everyone. in here. You know, that you're going to have Deathrite Shaman be an all-star in some matchups and Gurmag Angler be really good in others. You know, it.
And you get to have the stifle, no stifle talk. And that's a fun discussion to have.
Yeah, cool. I mean, it's just like it's impossible to play against, right? Because you're like, well, I can't. Like, if I play around Stifles and he doesn't have them, I'm just a chump. And if I don't play around Stifle and he has them, I'm an even bigger chump than that. So I guess I'm just going to sit here and lose. Because, like, what else can you do?
Yeah, I think the opportunity cost of not playing Stifle is too good to pass up. You get to play another card, and they still have to play around Stifle.
So that's a fact.
You're sort of getting them on both ends, right?
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, the way that you play around Stifle is by exposing yourself to Wasteland.
Yeah, that's true.
So you really just get them coming and going with that thing.
Yeah. So this is a great deck of magical cards.
Well, or it's the week you did decide to play Stifle, and they're finally not going to play around it anymore. And then
you get them.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that you don't love this deck, Casey.
So I think that Deathrite Shaman decks are usually pretty uninteresting because it's too much. It's like way too strong of a card. So I think that, the decks are just like not that fun. And one of the best parts about playing Delver is getting to stifle people. So,
but you could still do that in this deck if you wanted.
You can. And I don't know. The deck just feels weird. Like, I feel like Delver of Secrets is probably the worst card in the deck. And it just, like, the deck just is bizarre. I think it's good. It doesn't feel like a Delver deck to me.
There are Grixis control decks for Legacy that you could play if that's what you wanted to do.
I know that...
But I specifically don't want that.
I know that this weekend, Jerry Thompson, for example, was not playing Delvers in a deck that was very, very similar to that.
Yeah, man. What a good guy, that Alexander Hain. What a good guy. Look, his doesn't even play... Oh, it's like the same deck, except it just has the fourth Young Pyromancer. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, this deck, I remember when this deck came out, it was like a four of Cabal Therapy, four of Young Pyromancer.
Dark Confidant.
I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the Deathrite Shamans and the Delver of Secrets.
I think that Deathrite came later. People were playing Dark Confidant in that slot.
I don't remember that. I remember the four-color Delver deck that like played... Deathrite Shamans.
Oh, yeah, this was before
that. Edrix. It was Edrix.
Yeah, Edrix by Master of Trest came later.
Yeah.
But the original versions of Grixis Delver didn't play any green or Deathrite Shaman.
So what makes this deck so good? What makes it one of the top three decks? Is it just that wide net that Michael was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it does everything, right? Like, you do sometimes have Delver draws where, like, you just get to Delver people, but, like, you've got so much else going on.
Apparently, Keezy had one of those draws in Standard this week.
Yeah, that did happen.
How'd that feel?
It felt good.
I think that you're a terrible human being.
For convincing your opponents that Delver of Secrets is legal or something else?
No, he like had was, like guide was, your Mokus command, kill your guy, kill your guy, kill your guy, and you're dead.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Counter your creature. Like, it was Lamholt Pacifist into Dromoka's command, kill your guy, Declaration and Stone your next guy, Ojutai's command, your next guy. And then, like, the game was just over.
Oh, man, I'm tingly just thinking about it. That sounds
great. You guys are, like, not real people. But those are the kind of draws that we're talking about with these Delver decks where, you know, you play a Delver Secrets or a Deathrite Shaman or even a Young Pyromancer. You just play an early threat, and then you just stop them from playing Magic. It's what people think Death and Taxes does for some reason, which isn't what that deck does.
No, Death and Taxes just makes what you do not matter.
Yeah, which is different.
Right. I think it's even sadder because you're like, I've got these cards in play. None of them do anything. Where with Delver, like, you get to look at your hand and feel sad.
Miracles comes in next with 38 points.
You know, several points.
The same Miracles. Number of points as the last three decks combined. No big deal.
Didn't that happen last week, too?
Last time?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I think it was green-white. Had the same as 2, 3, and 4 combined. It's interesting.
Yeah, they're two broken formats. And that's what happens in broken formats. We don't have to have the conversation. Instead, let's just say that this deck is the best deck in Legacy. It's by quite a big margin. You know, it has bad matchups against a few, basically the decks in the top. The other decks in this top five all have, you know, reasonable Miracles matchups.
Yeah, Delver is like pretty close to a coin flip with Miracles. Infect and Shardless both have good matchups with Miracles. Storm is it can really go either way. I don't know that I feel comfortable calling that a good or a bad matchup for either of them. just because there's so many different things that can happen there.
I think ultimately, I think I would rather be on the miracle side of that than the storm side of that. Interesting.
I think I would rather be on the storm side.
Interesting.
Well, so I wonder if that's a visceral hate for miracles, though.
I mean, counterbalance looks a lot like two mana win the game.
That's true. It can. Because you get a counterbalance because you have, like, your deck is designed for with all these one drops. It's, like, easy to just blind flip a one drop, and they just blind flip one and stop a ritual.
Right, and then that's usually good enough.
To be fair, though, like, having us both on different sides of it makes me feel like it's certainly an interesting matchup. It's one I've enjoyed playing from both sides, and it's reasonably close.
Yeah, I think all of these have to have some semblance of a matchup against Miracles.
Others. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think that with Storm, your best draws are favored against almost anything. Like, it's... Like, I've had Mulligans to 5 that could win on turn 1 through counter magic with Storm. Like, you sometimes have it.
So what would you guys play in Legacy and why?
For me, it would be either Storm, for all the reasons we talked about today, or Sneak and Show, because that's just a sweet deck. I got to play it in my first Legacy Gauntlet, and man, it was the trip down memory lane.
That's actually what I was playing in the Legacy Gauntlet right before I headed over. Deck is very, very amusing. I was really enjoying myself. I certainly would not mind playing that in a Legacy event.
I would play the 4-color deck. I've been playing that a lot lately.
Oh, the Mox Chalice Diamond
the
one?
Yeah, the Mox Diamond one, yeah. I said Cro-Mox earlier, by the way, guys, and I meant Mox Diamond. I apologize for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know what you meant, because it's a good deck, and, like, Cro-Mox is only barely good enough in, like, degenerate decks.
Yeah, I would play the Knight deck. I think that deck is sweet, and I've really been enjoying it.
Yeah, I think that it's a good deck for the right metagames. Like, if your metagame is very creature-oriented, that is
or
a
miracles oriented.
Really good deck. Yeah, I would assume that you're probably reasonable against miracles.
Yeah, I've been doing pretty well against that deck. I don't know if it's like, it's not like Shardless level good, but it's really good, and it's really good against Shardless Bug. So
right, that would be my instinct, is that it would be great against Shardless, good against Death and Taxes, good against Delver. I feel like you could find yourself in the hardlock against miracles, where, like, because that deck's not very fast, and if they can start counting,
you still,
like,
have Abrupt Decay.
That is true, but, like, they dig through their deck a lot more than you do, right? Like, on average, even if you're playing the same number, they're going to find more counterbalances than you find Abrupt Decays.
That could be true. Could definitely be true. I've enjoyed the deck. I've had reasonable success against most things, and I lost to lands the other day on Cockatrice. By the way, don't play against lands on Cockatrice.
Or ever.
But
what a nightmare.
But it's been a fun deck to play with, so... Let's go into our next segment. So every week on this podcast, we do a training grounds. Training grounds is a card in Magic that you can pay that makes your activated cost 2 less. It was in the same set as level up, as leveling, you know, so level up your guys for an activation. And so, you know, we're not here to make you, to, like, instantly give you a red mushroom and make you grow, you know, your heart grows 3 sizes that day. But we are... Because, first of all, that would put June cardiac arrest.
Right, you would die.
Yeah. I mean, also because we're combining welcome. Stories here.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Mixing metaphors, to say the least.
There was a lot of them there. Leveling up, red mushroom, the Grinch was still Christmas. You don't have to...
It's getting complicated.
You don't have to point them all out. The joke was for them to figure it out.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Also, I'm the one that pointed them all out. But we are here to, like, help you in your journey to improve in Magic in ways that we've improved at Magic. You know, I'm not Paulo Vitor, I'm not LSV, but I'm me, and I've learned stuff. And hopefully, if what I have learned I can share with you, and you can either do it or improve upon it, it can help you get better at Magic. So,
it's a good personal statement. I'm me, and I've learned stuff.
Allegedly.
You know, Casey's is, I know everything, so...
No, you just say things with enough conviction that people assume you know what you're talking about.
let's talk about... So this week on the podcast, we gave patrons of the show, we gave them a few options, and we said, hey, like, once every quarter, every 2 months? I don't know. We'll figure it out. I think we said once every quarter, but we might do it more than that. We're going to let the patrons of the show pick the topic, and then I'll write a show about it. And they wanted playtesting part 4.
It's a lot of parts.
So this time specifically, we're going to be talking about a few things. We want to talk about how we test matchups and why we do it the way we do it. You know, and then we want to talk a little bit about mulligans and the kind of decks that we're testing and like the cards we're testing in them. So how we test matchups and why we do it this way. So we do best of five, switch off, play in the draw. We also switch off decks between each other quite a bit. We do infinite slots in sideboards a lot of the time. Not all the time, but a lot of the time we'll just be playing a matchup and what cards would I bring in this matchup and grab them, write them down, and board them in. And then we then tighten up later. Sometimes we'll be when we're testing like specific matchups, you know, with our decks, we will then have a 15 card sideboard. But a lot of the testing happens with
especially proxying. Especially while you're brewing, you know, you'll have like a 30 card sideboard, really, like infinite and whatever, but like you really end up actually using 30 cards or so.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, these cards overperform, these cards underperform. You start to cull the
this matchup was so good I didn't need any board.
Right, exactly. And start to really figure out the nuances of that, and then you get it down to 20-ish and then 15.
Yeah. So a lot of you know that stuff happens kind of weirdly. So that's kind of where we're gonna focus. The sideboarding stuff, by the way, these are actually all things that we've talked about before. The best of five, switching decks, all of those were in episodes one. That's why I just want to talk about them really quick. We're good. We've done all of those.
Okay.
All right. So those are in previous episodes, but those are the basics of like basic sideboarding or basic playtesting stuff that we do. How do we do mulligans? This has changed a lot of times.
Yes, it has.
Right now, the most common one that I find myself doing with you guys is 7-6-6-5-7. So what that means is I mulligan from 7 to 6, from 6 to 6, from 6 to 5, from 5 to 7. The reason that we do this, or the reason that I do this, is because that's how my role models do it.
Well, I mean, the foundation of it is that there's actually no point testing a 4-card hand.
Yeah, right? And there's also no point testing 17 5-card hands.
Right. Well, basically, no matchup is good when you mold a 4. When you mold a 4, you're almost certainly losing. That's just something you are
going you'll win. There's great stories that come from that, right?
That's true, but you're a huge underdog.
Yeah, right. I mean, like
that's, but that's better than saying that you're going to lose, right?
Yeah, that is true. So, but it happens so infrequently that testing the 4-card hand is
doesn't
not
give
good
you information. Doesn't give you information.
Right.
The same thing can be said about, like, well, why don't you mulligan 7-6-5-7? Well, because you do actually mulligan to 6 quite a bit.
Yeah. Mulliganing to 6, you know, once every other match is, like, pretty common. Maybe even a little bit more than that. It's not that often that you're going to have to go below 6, but it does happen. So it's important to see the 5-card hands, in, you know, once in a while.
It's also too important to, when you're making these, it's important to actually play mulligan games. One of the reasons is because if your deck is mulliganing a lot and you're still winning a lot, that's important information. If your deck is mulliganing a lot and you're losing a lot because of the mulligans, that's important information. But if you're just like, you know, drawing a 7, drawing a 7, drawing a 7.
That's cherry picking, right?
Like, yeah. You're like, oh, my deck's insane.
Well, you're going to find decks with high variance to overperform if you're not mulliganing, right? I mean, if you're just drawing a new 7 every time, you're going to end up with
decks. Yeah, my Storm deck suddenly got really good.
Right. Oh, man, all my matchups are great.
Mono Red is so powerful when you play that way. Like, it doesn't represent what playing the deck is like.
Right.
But then the flip side is, right, when you start going below 6, it stops always representing what matchups actually look like as well, because your percentages start shifting pretty drastically with someone on 5 versus a 7.
Yeah, I remember in the original Team Oasis games playtesting sheets, like when we got something like 30 players in Utah to join a Team Oasis games, and the playtesting sheets had some real interesting stuff on there, like, did this person get mana screwed or mana flooded, and this or that. And it was like some of the most useless information to like that you can't, that like it's so much better for you just to internalize it than to,
because it's not data.
It's not data. I mean, unless like every single one of those sheets said that deck got mana flooded every single time, then it's not a data point.
Yeah. That 40 lands is too many.
Yeah.
And it's time to start culling some.
Yeah. So that, you know, but interesting information actually is those Mulligans. It actually is interesting to note how those Mulligans happened, why they happened, how often they happened.
Well, what was funny is that sheet had room for like all the Manusphere Mana Flood stuff, but it only had Mulligan yes or no. Not to what number. So
that is interesting. You know, there's the data that you're looking for. You want important data in playtesting. And, you know, it's, you know, you can be as analytical as you want in playtesting, in all honesty. Like, there are, you know, you can get pretty analytical. But a lot of it's going to be, how did that Mulligan feel?
Yeah, I mean, it's, sometimes you are trying to gut it out, right? Because Magic is a game where you can play the same matchup 10 times in a row, and the games will all be a little bit different, right? The cards will line up a little bit differently. A hand that felt insane, again, like you can have the exact same draw, but your opponent has a different enough draw that it no longer feels insane.
Yeah, we actually have a spreadsheet that we have that's not being used right now, and I think it's not being reused because I'm not pushing it, because there's no reason to use a spreadsheet in the standard format for matchups. And one of the questions that Matt asked me is, like, what's the point in this? Like, what is the possible reason could I have for knowing these numbers? And I was like, well, if you're trying to pick between two decks, it's nice to know, like, what their approximate win percentages against the field are. Or, like, to show, like, there's small things that, like, so you can get as analytical as that, right? Where that information might be really important to Casey, like...
Yeah, like, knowing how a deck, you know, lines up against two or three decks, it can be a big difference. Like, okay, the SCG, like, this deck is killing it, but in our metagame, it's really these three decks. And right. These three decks are all soft to this.
Yeah. So that's interesting to hear about, because I always feel like if you're too preoccupied with sort of what decks are good in matchups, you lose a lot of opportunity to just play better in those matchups and win games.
So exactly. So that was Matt's thought. He's like, oh, well, why does this even matter?
So when I'm playtesting, one of the things I'm trying to do is sort of polish rather than come up with all these like numbers and raw data. I'm interested in like trying to basically polish heuristics. So when I'm falling back on like thought patterns during a match, they're better than they were before I'd playtested.
Right. That's kind of where I was going is the numbers are great. The numbers are something you want to look for, but like knowing how to play the decks, like the numbers, unless they're staggering, they should kind of just be like this thing that you know and you can look at and you can understand. But like knowing that my deck has a 67% matchup against something,
right,
doesn't actually make me better at playing the matchup, right?
Exactly. And I think the reality is that most matchups are actually relatively close, and there's a lot of play to them. There are very few matchups where it is just so good or so bad that you can't help but win or lose. And I think if you get too caught up in the, well, this deck is supposed to be 70% in this matchup, you sort of,
right,
you're sort of either overconfident or overly defeatist before you've actually played the game.
It's true.
Yeah, and one thing that pitfalls that I do see people fall into is you get in your head that this matchup is really good because of how good your sideboard is for it, but then you fall for the classic trap of, this matchup's so good, I don't need these sideboard cards. And I see that happen all the time. So that is something to be very wary of when you are just looking at numbers and not the whole picture.
So playtesting creative list versus stock lists. What makes a list stock, Casey?
Well, a stock list is kind of a composite deck list to me. Sometimes it's, you know, just a random top eight or tournament winning deck, but you should be trying to go for a composite. If, you know, sometimes people play some of this and some of this, like trying to get like a reasonable mix of the cards people play. And decks on average don't fluctuate that many cards. I can't think of a popular deck that there were extremely different variations of it in standard recently.
What makes a creative list, Michael?
I think sometimes you want to be creative when it comes to testing something yourself. Creative in the sense, a lot of the time, just means finding a new card you like. It doesn't have to necessarily be a big change, but even a small change can sometimes really change how certain matchups play out.
So I'm playing Grixis. I'm playtesting against Grixis Control. I have found in my testing that it's important to have two Dragonlord Silumgars and one Silumgars Command of the main. Is that a creative list or a stock list?
Well, I think that stock, by definition, like you're looking for what everybody's doing, right? So if it if that is like technology that you invented and nobody else is playing it, then I think that it would classify as creative.
So here's the thing. Here's my thought process on this, because this was actually something brought up by our teammate Nick, and I thought it was super interesting. Inbred testing does not come about from playing against creative versus stock lists. It comes about from playtesting decks built to beat your decks, and then trying to beat the decks that you built to beat your decks.
Yeah.
It's a much bigger process than just like, here's the best list that I found for this deck. Here's the best list that I found for this deck. Let's jam them together. That is not a problem. That is not inbred. Inbred is when you're building decks to beat the decks that you built to beat the decks that there are.
So, or we're both trying to test completely off the wall brews, and then we're fine tuning them to beat each other.
Yeah, right. That's inbred.
Right. Exactly.
So to me, a creative list is something you can have. You can have creativity in your stock lists. If I find that I want two Silumgars in my deck, and I find that from seeing the decks that I like are playing two Silumgars, the deck list that I'm testing against, the deck list that I'm testing with, and I see other people doing it, your list doesn't have to be like the most generic thing to test against. It's like Casey said, you should probably play against some number of Den Protectors in green-white. You should probably play against Angelic Purge in green-white. Even though not every list plays those cards, it's already come to the... people have already come to the conclusion that they're very good cards in that deck. So even though not all of them play it, the best versions of them have played them.
Yeah, exactly.
In one form or another. So just because they're in your deck does not make your deck inbred. Michael, you seem to disagree.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. What I would say is that it's important to keep in mind cards you could be playing, because sometimes you'll be testing against a deck and realize that you actually think the deck you're testing against is way better than the deck you're playing with, and you should just switch. And if you're intentionally playing lists that don't have things you agree with, like if you think you really need two Dragonlord Silumgars in Grixis, but you keep playing against the deck with one of them because you saw that, you know, Oliver 2 played one with one or whatever, sometimes you're going to not let yourself find a deck that you actually really like, even if it's only a relatively minor difference, by sort of beating your head into the wall, trying to prove that something you thought you liked better beats a version of a deck that isn't even the version of it that you like.
The important thing to think here is, I don't think I'm close to the best player in the world, right? I typically think if I find something, others can easily find it. And if I think otherwise than that, then that's a little bit different, right? Like, for example, when you go into a tournament and you a lot of times technology is discovered at the same time. Angelic Purge in green-white, for example. Like, lots of people had it.
Yeah.
At that tournament.
Yeah, that one weekend. Like, it went from not a card to a card.
To everyone had it, and everybody was trying to keep it a secret. It's not... that kind of technology is not the... I mean, you should keep it a secret, right? But there's no... like, for me, it's like, oh, I... you know, you only won because you had Angelic Purge. Well, that's a data point, right? That's not a knock against the deck that you're testing with. Because, oh, that card won you the game and nobody plays that, so this matchup is good for me. It's like...
Right, if someone else figures that out, am I now saying that I can't win this matchup?
You suddenly
anymore?
Can't win the matchup if somebody else figures that out? Like, it's okay to test creative cards against other creative things. It's not okay to test brews against each other. That doesn't do anything for you. So it's important to know the difference between a creative list, a stock list, and just a non-existent deck.
Angelic Purge is really good against me, so I'm going to start playing this, which is really good against Angelic Purge. And now in the list that was playing Angelic Purge, I'm going to stick this in there because it's really good against the card that's really good against Angelic
that's
Purge.
That's an example of inbreeding. So it's a fine line, but it's not as fine as people say, I guess.
Yeah, I think you just have to be aware of it, right? Just like knowing that it's a possibility kind of prevents it from happening to you, because you're not going to fall for it. And when you start thinking things like, you know, oh, I need to start playing Hydro Blast in my Merfolk deck because you can't be burned without it, like, that's lunacy. But I think that...
yeah, chill's way better anyway.
Exactly. So, anyway.
Main deck chills. Like, That's inbreeding, right? Yeah, a main deck chill is like,
it's super aggressive.
Actually, I actually think this happened somewhere. I was at an SEG and somebody was playing, no, it was GP Albuquerque or Phoenix. Anyway, this guy had this, like, these main deck cards, and I asked him, I was like, what is, it was like round four or five. I was like, what is this for? He goes, oh, this is this Pyxis of Pandemonium deck that's like really good at my store. And I was like, what?
Oh, yeah. He was playing like some kind of main deck Shatter.
Something like that. I just asked him about it. He goes, yeah, there's this like crazy good Pyxis of Pandemonium deck at my store. And I knew my friend was playing it at the GP. And I was like, so that's...
That's not a thing. That's not part of a strategy.
Yeah. You know, that's the kind of thing where it's like, where you did something, that's inbreeding, right? It's like, oh, my, like, whereas if you, my, the answer to your question is, we discovered Angelic Purge, and we thought others would discover it, so we did this. That's a good reason.
Right, that's just a but good like, reason. That's saying, staying a step ahead.
Right. But saying, oh, and especially if the card is just good outside of, if they are playing Angelic Purge. I don't know what card would be good against Angelic Purge, by the way. I'm just using that
it would probably be more about how you would play around it rather than cards you would play against it.
Yeah, and the thing is like something like a like this entire Pyxis of Pandemonium archetype is like I actually went across the GP floor to find that guy and he was 2-3.
Well, you basically have you have like two options, right? Either you don't do this or the Pyxis of Pandemonium deck is so good that you just play it.
Yeah, exactly. Did we just
Man, that was like the same sentence. That was actually kind of creepy.
That was creepy.
Yeah. Or like, you know, if we go way back to when people were actually just living their lives that way in Standard, playing 28 naturalizes in their main deck, trying to beat Affinity, and still losing to it, like, just suck it up and play Affinity. Like, if your testing is so inbred that, like, you can fine-tune a deck and you're still losing to it, and, like, you think that it's going to be a significant part of the metagame, just don't play the deck.
I think that, well, the point I'm trying to get to is you should play against the best version of the deck that you think exists. Because that's going to give you a better idea of how to play against the, you know, good cards, you know, as many cards as you can, right? I think that's important. You know, I know a lot of people are like, well, this is the list that Patrick Chapin posted. And so that's the version that I'm playtesting against because that's going to be the most popular. I've literally never seen anyone copy a deck ever in my, like, ever.
I think it happens a lot. They just, you know, you don't talk about it, so, like, you don't necessarily know.
No, dude, every person puts their own spin on a deck.
I don't think that's true.
I think it is.
I think it's true of, like, enough of the people that we know.
I think that it's true of so many people.
I think that of the general population of people who play, like, competitive tournaments, usually are real by the book. You know, like, that's why the same lists usually, like, are taught in top eights, because people are basically, like, the greatest percentage of the room is playing them.
I think that I usually don't see the same 75, and I specifically don't see them from, like, articles posted by pros that doing well at events.
But I don't think it necessarily matters. Like, the bigger consideration is when you're testing, don't get hyper-focused on the exact list you're playing against and consider that, like, when you're playing in an event, someone could be playing that exact 75, but, you know, don't get real caught up in, well, they only have one Dragonlord Silumgar. Like, they might have two. They might have three. Who knows? Like,
they could have four. Probably not more
probably
than that,
probably not, but, you know.
Probably also not four. I mean, they could.
But you have to have those kind of considerations, and if you get really caught up in, like, this is exactly how my playtesting went, so this is exactly how matches are going to play out, people aren't necessarily going to be on the same list. They're not necessarily going to sequence things the same way.
I think a huge thing like this is people... I've actually heard this come out of their mouth. Oh, yeah. He had main deck Declaration in Stone, and nobody plays that in green-white. And I'm like, what? What do you mean nobody? Well, yeah, the deck that just one didn't play them. And this actually was a conversation that I had with somebody. I was like, so one deck that you saw that did well at a tournament didn't play Declaration in Stone, so you thought that none of them did it. Yeah. You thought none of them played the best removal in the format because that one guy decided not to. Yeah. Well, that's an unreasonable...
That's a weird leap of logic, right? Where, like, one deck does not... One tournament is not the weather vane for
how the deck is played. And one deck list is not the deck list, right? You know, it's important that you play against what you think is the best. You play against what you think is the best, and you learn what you can about the matchup. That's what playtesting is for, right? It is to solidify your list, but it's not to, like, it's not to harp on about what you're playtesting against, right?
I mean, sometimes you can lose sight of the forest for the trees, right? Like, you're getting bogged down in details. We're like, oh, this matchup is X because of Y, where, like, that one card or that one strategy may be different in this deck, but you can still look at the bigger picture of what the deck is doing. Like, if your deck just doesn't line up well against that deck, regardless of how many Slumgars they're playing.
What about testing the villain deck? What about being the person that's playing that other deck? Michael, what is the benefit of sitting down and being the guy that's going to beat the bloody pulp out of the guy that, like, is trying to figure out what deck he wants to play?
Okay, so a few things. First of all, it gets you off of playing brews because you just play someone else's brew and beat it up over and over again with a deck that's really good. So it will probably improve your deck selection to spend more time playing the best decks and less time playing your own whatever. And I mean, I think we're all guilty of that at times, but I definitely think that if you sit down and play, you know, the gauntlet against someone
maybe,
else testing
maybe
their own
one
brew,
day Michael or myself might pick up Expert Dragons.
Yeah.
Anything could happen.
It could. It's something I wish would happen. I'm just not good at it. So,
well, and also just like knowing how the deck operates, right? It gives you insight. Yeah. So, like, I would never play Tron in a tournament. I would rather not play Magic than play Tron. But I have no problem playing Tron in playtesting because I want to know how to beat Tron. I want to know if I have a hand that makes me want to sequence my lands in a way that's strange, and I see that from my opponent, I know what their hand looks like.
I love playing hyper-aggressive decks in playtesting. It makes me feel alive. It makes me feel like the world is my oyster and everyone should bow down before me. But I hate playing those decks in tournaments. But one of the reasons that I love them so much is because I get to feel what my opponents feel. And that's not just true of hyper-aggressive decks, right? You can have that feeling with every deck that you play in playtesting. And that's great, right? You can feel alive. There was a match that Austin was playing at the PPTQ this week where we left the room and I was like, well, you know, you can go home happy today. You got your match where your opponent, you had 7 cards in hand. They had no permanents in play outside of lands. You had 2 planeswalkers. All your mana was untapped. You know, and you got, they didn't concede to you. You did it. You got to play your Esper deck through an entire game like that. Like, your day is complete. And you don't get those feelings, like, a ton, but you can have them in playtesting. You can understand. You can really get inside the head of some players by playing those kind of decks and playing with and against. And it's so great, man. Magic is so fun. I'm, like, really excited. I'm, like, want to go playtest right now. I'm, like, shaking.
Yeah, and it just those little insights can add up to a lot over the course of a tournament, right?
And knowing what cards you were scared of in playtesting, like when you're playing those decks, right? When you're sitting across the table from your opponent and like they do something that's like, oh my gosh, that was so good against me. And that means that next time you're playing against that deck, you know that that kind of interaction is scary for them.
Like, oh, this card is surprisingly powerful here.
I think too, when you see the little things in sequencing, like, you know, like Casey was saying, where like certain land patterns might indicate a higher likelihood that they have certain cards in their hand, because when you're playing that deck, you have to sequence that way. And it's hard to see from across the table sometimes, because when you can't see someone's hand, you're not necessarily going to have a full picture if you've never played with the deck of why that kind of sequencing would make sense just based on looking at a deck list. But oftentimes, if you play a few test games, you start seeing that, like, okay, well, if I need to hold up Dromoka's Command, I'm going to try to lead with my lands this way. And if I'm not holding up Dromoka's Command, then I might play this way because it'll give me a better chance at untapped mana on a different turn. So there are all kinds of little things like that that can help you get a better read on your opponents that you could pick up in playtesting, even if you don't actually want or have any intention of playing the deck that you're playing with in testing.
Yeah. I hope all of these were great tips that you guys can take with you into playtesting in your next session. You know, whether it's just you and your friend, whether it's the 4 people, you know, we've talked about different ways that you can do that. But I hope that, like, you know, try some of this. You know, think, don't focus on the things that don't matter. Focus on the, like, the data that you can understand. Focus on feelings. You know, if you feel like a matchup should be good and it's playing out badly, you know, realize that maybe that matchup's not good for you. But if you feel like this is like, I love this matchup, this is a great matchup, it's that's important. That's you know, that you're not going to be able to play 1,000 games with every deck. That's, you don't have the time in the world. But
unless
unless you invent a time machine, in which case you shouldn't be playing Magic.
Hey, yeah.
We've already discussed
inventing Magic.
You should be inventing a lot of stuff.
I think we decided that the roulette wheel is like the way to go, right? It's like zero time investment, you get rich real quick.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, as bad as that
sounds.
And
then you can go play all the Magic you want anyway.
What a life. What a life.
But yeah, I hope that each and every one of you, you know, I hope this helped. It might be. You know, you can improve upon it. You can take it with, you know, a grain of salt. But this is what we're doing. This is what we think. And let us know what you think. You know, leave a comment. Let us know. Don't worry, you can join the MTGO clan by messaging me, Spencer13H. Or no, Spencer13Dev. That's D-E-V. That's my wife's name. You can message me on MTGO. I'm happy to add you to the clan. You can also message Quentin at Earthstripe. That's U-R-T-H-S-T-R-Y-P-E. Yeah. Got there. You can check out our sponsor, Oasis Games. Great place to buy Magic cards. Pure MTGO, MTGO traders. If you're looking for some awesome content as well as some cards on Modo, that's literally all we buy cards from on Modo. It's just, just do it. You'll never regret it. It's so great.
Yeah, I agree. I actually just bought a standard deck from them.
And what'd you buy?
Banned.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. That's why your Modo's been going off in your bedroom.
Yep.
I like woke up at like 6 a.m. and I'm walking downstairs like groggy as all can be.
And I was playing the Legacy Gauntlet.
I know you were playing a Legacy Gauntlet that morning. It might have been like 4 a.m. I don't even remember what time it was. But like, I hear like, dun, 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 and I was like,
Magic Online sounds.
It's like, what the heck? Casey, he's up and ready to go. But yeah, check out our sponsors. Don't forget you can join the Patreon and become a patron of the show by going to patreon.com/ccmtg. And man, do we appreciate it. Well, that was weird.
You got to connect to the internet, dummy.
That was strange. Our next goal is just more types of content, you know, whether it's brewing after brews. At $400, we'll think of a month. We'll do some more content for you. There's already videos, streams, deck techs, vlogs. There's tons of stuff. Check out the YouTube channel at youtube.com. You know, just search Constructed Criticism. You'll find us. It's a great place to devour some extra content if you have the time. Yeah, that should be good. Where can people find you guys, though?
You can.
Michael's going first.
Oh,
I didn't know that. I don't think he knew that either.
Man.
Just kidding.
You can find me in the Facebook group, or I mean, not in the Facebook group, just on Facebook in general. My name is Michael Hinderacher. If you add me as a friend, I will also add you as a friend. Or if you just want to tag me in a post, I will respond embarrassingly quickly. You can find me on Twitter at MagicMikeMTG.
That's a great Twitter handle.
It truly is.
It's solid.
You can find me on Facebook.
I was going to go, Casey. Just kidding.
I quit. You can find me on Facebook at Casey Tuna Bloodworth. If you want to talk to me about something in the Facebook group, tag me because I don't check it that much. You can tweet at me at CC Bloodthirst, or I'm going to be playing a lot more Magic Online in the near future, so you can find me at Sneaky Fish.
Sneaky Fish. You can find me on Twitter at Spencer13H. You can find me in the Facebook group. We are still looking for... So there is a Reddit subreddit. It hasn't been used since I announced it last time. People got really excited about it, and then it kind of died off real quick. But there is a CCMTG subreddit. It's actually just CCMTG. But the Facebook group is like the best way to communicate. And I'm going to do better about using it. I've been slacking lately. Did I announce the baby on the podcast?
I don't know.
Oh, well, I'm having a baby, and so my time and
mine. Dev
does know.
Oh, okay.
That's
fortunately.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm real pregnant. That's why my tummy's so big. But she also was pregnant.
So, oh, okay.
That's real awkward. But yeah, so that's why you guys might have found me to be distant is just a lot of stuff going on. Promotion at work, pregnant wife, you know, a puppy, you know, that's not a puppy anymore, but
she's just a really small dog.
But yeah, hashtag would that be good. Hashtag would that be good is our Twitter outreach program. Every week on the podcast, we read all of the tweets from hashtag would that be good, as long as they're appropriate to read on the podcast. This week, we have, oh, well, that's a great start to it. Wait, what is this? Losing friends to turn one signal pest, turn to double burning tree, Memnite Ornithopter.
What?
What?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Burning tree emissary in affinity. That
you could just play Frogmite, right?
Don't tell Scotty how to live his life.
Right. I don't know. Probably, but you can't play like with this. You can like start with burning tree emissary. Right? You can go like burning tree, cranial plating.
But don't lose your friends over it. It's not worth it.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it feels.
Yeah, it's certainly not good to lose friends.
Yeah, friends don't, are a valuable resource.
Don't lose your friends, but only kill them.
But I'm actually curious, what's the reason to play Burning Tree over Frogmite?
That it's sweeter.
Way sweeter.
Well, so that's true. Is that a good reason?
No, but I feel like I think Scotty's a brewer.
I love Scotty, by the way. I think we say it every week, but that guy's got he's an ideas man.
Exactly. It's like it's just about having an idea that floats around the back of your head and then making a deck out of it, right? Like
you just have to try
old school brewing. Like, let's spin the wheel, let's see if this works.
I tweeted, you can call me Mr. McPunterson, and then the Matt says, don't you mean Heezy McPunterson? I mean, that's my first name, but I told you to call me Mr.
No, Mr. McPunterson is your father.
That's Mr. McPunterson to you.
He's Sir McPunterson. I don't know.
Oh, fancy.
Yeah, schmancy pants.
Esquire.
Yeah. Honest Bob says, I really enjoyed playing Bant Humans recently. What is the best tech for the mirror? Hashtag would that be good? Hashtag MTG. So I actually played against Bant Humans that was splashing for Eldrazi Displacer and Reality Smasher. Eldrazi Displacer and the main Reality Smasher of the board, and I was like, well, this is broken. This is how you make the mirror not stupid, because you just bounce your own lieutenant.
Or your Reflector Mages, or you just tap down your opponent's creatures, right?
Yeah, so that would be my guess for the best deck.
I believe that took second at Star City.
Oh, did it?
Atlanta this weekend, and it had top-hated a GP the weekend before that, so... Yeah, I would say
like a while
officially
ago.
That is the best way to play the mirror.
It's just Bygone Bishop.
Wait,
Flyers.
There was an SCG this weekend?
No, that was last weekend.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, Todd Stevens did have Eldrazi Displacer. He did not have...
What in the world is Graphmole?
That card is whenever you sacrifice a clue, you gain 3 life.
Powerful.
For a 2/4 for 3.
You get approximately 700 clues in this deck in an average game, so that does seem good.
So apparently the story with this was that Todd Stevens and Tom Ross were at a bar the night before the event, and Todd Stevens asked Tom Ross for a sideboard card to help him gain life in aggressive matchups. Tom Ross recommended him Graph Mole and beat him in the finals.
Get it.
It's a mole, all right.
Yeah, that's next level.
And look,
level.
It's your favorite card, Casey, Profaner of the Dead.
All right, what does that card do?
It does what we thought it did. It says exploit. It's a 4-mana 3/3. When it enters the battlefield, or when the Profaner of the Dead exploits, a creature return to their owner's hand all creatures your opponents control with toughness less than the exploited creature's toughness. So not all creatures, just your opponents.
Okay.
That seems potentially good in the mirror. Although I guess if you can bounce all your opponent's creatures, you could probably just attack too. So. Like, if you have something with higher toughness than a bunch of their creatures, it's entirely possible your attacks are already lining up well.
But I mean, you might just have one Tree of Redemption and a bunch of little guys. You don't
know. Is that the 013?
Yeah.
That card is so fun.
For who?
Whoever has Profaner of the Dead.
Dragon Lord Dromoka in the green-white token sideboard. Hashtag with a good. I've seen people do this. I think it's totally fine.
Yeah, I mean, it swallows Abyssins.
But, you know, Danny... I recommend, you know, just skipping the Pro Tour, man. Like, don't really do that. I'm just kidding. yeah, I think Dragon Lord Dromoka is perfectly reasonable in that deck, in the sideboard, so.
Yeah, you might have to go up a land. 25 might be short for a 7 drop. Is it 6 or 7?
6, I believe.
6. Maybe that's doable.
Some people are going up to 26 anyways, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's the life I live. It's the life Jerry Thompson lives.
That was my
It's a pretty good life.
What does TFW stand for?
That face win.
Oh, that face when you are up, dressed, and ready before your alarm goes off. Let's battle. Hashtag GP Columbus. Hashtag MTG. Hashtag would that be good? Heck yeah, it's good. Look, he's even got a sweet profile picture of him at his feature match at the GP.
That's the face he was making. That's what he's talking about. That's the face. The face. Yeah.
Looks intense. It's a good face. Looks intense.
It's a good face. All right, everybody. Let us know if you have any additional questions, concerns, comments, and go crush some people. Thanks, everybody. Magic.